Hello and welcome to Grow Global, our podcast series number 9. And today we are going to be speaking about how educators can be more inclusive. Welcome to Grow Global. I am your host, Patricia Demetrio. Grow Global is sponsored by Platinum Credit Group. They help individuals and organizations with financial education to help them with startup loans and or working capital. They provide in-depth credit, income, and financial background reviews before submitting applications to lenders on business owners' behalf. We are truly grateful to Platinum Credit Group for helping to fund this podcast, which in part helps to make this show possible. Hello, and welcome to Grow Global. I'm your host, Patricia Demetrio. In today's episode, we will talk about how educators can be more inclusive, not to be confused with inclusion. Our guest today is Matthew Stewart. Matthew Stewart is head of the Cadman School, a Montessori pre and elementary school in New York City. Matthew is also the co-director of the Spence Teaching Institutes, focused on issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Matthew was Klingstein's Fellow at Teachers College, Columbia University, where he earned a master's in education administration and holds additional educational qualifications from Harvard University and Northwestern University. He has been a trustee for the Center for Racial Justice in Education and was co-chair of the Board of Leadership and Design, a leading organization for innovation in education. He currently serves as president of the Guild of New York City Heads of Schools and is on the board of Brooklyn Heights Montessori School at ISANI, Independent Association of Admissions in Greater New York. Thank you so much, Mr. Stewart, for coming to the show. We really appreciate having you here today. In the name of Life Smart Education and Grow Global podcast, we want to thank you for the service in the fields of education, diversity, and inclusion. Well, let's just go ahead and get in first to our first question then. How can a teacher, let's just go in for the record to define the difference specifically, like you just mentioned. Let's just repeat that. And sure. Then go into the first question, how can a teacher then be more inclusive after sure. You tell us the difference?
Sure. One of the things you and I discussed was the word inclusive and the word inclusion. And as what I have discovered in my own journey is often the word inclusion is used in the context of kids who need academic accommodations like ADHD, OT, they're on the autism spectrum. And so an inclusion teacher is a person trained for that. That's why, we often say DEIB, diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, to talk about inclusive teaching, because we're talking about more of a kind of including and belonging for everyone in the school. Now, that can include learning differences, but we're talking right now about the overall cultural sense of belonging, regardless of, what's the majority group of people in your school. Are others feeling that they're not as included as others? Are others feeling they don't belong? And that's our focus today is on having a school where people feel included at across all, all ways, my family, my race, my family structure, my gender, my parents' gender, and that I feel I belong in an equal way to everybody in the room. And you ask, how can a teacher work to ensure that? And I always say, the truth is you have to start with yourself. I mean, so you've invited a white male to talk about an inclusive classroom. But I'm also a head of school. So I have a lot of power in the structure of the school and supporting the teachers who want to be inclusive. I have the power to say this is a priority at our school. But then for me, and I'm also, I happen to be a gay male, a gay white male. So there is a piece of me that provides empathy. But there's also a years of really going a certain power places where I wasn't challenged. So I bring that to all conversations. So you have to start with yourself. You know, and a group of white heads of schools here in New York City created a group. We meet every other Thursday on Zoom for 45 minutes early in the morning and just ask ourselves, okay, so what can we do as white heads of schools to think about making sure we have anti-racist, sensitive, inclusive, belonging schools, that we're leading those schools? So in other words, number one, who am I, anyone who wants to be inclusive, who am I? What am I bringing to the table? How can I grow? How can I challenge myself? How can I know myself better so that I can concentrate? And then I have to, you know, look at my growth. I have to think about professional development for myself that will open my mind to the work. And then, you know, as a teacher, I need to look at the curriculum and the way I present it and who's included in the curriculum. And you know, can I see any places where, oh, I guess this is actually some bias on my part. I, you know, didn't intend that. And so often, that's the other piece of this. Rarely do people intend to be racist. Do they intend it? So we always use these great words, impact, you know, intent. And you can certainly, you need to seek out, well, what's the impact? And also give yourself the permission of what you intended, and then learn from your impact and learn from people's reactions. And so, you know, I knew someone who created a course designed at thinking about a diverse classroom. And in the student feedback, she found out that the majority of the great scholars she had included as readings in the curriculum were white scholars talking about race. And so people pointed out, you know, you need to diversify your reading for this class, because you're really looking at it through one lens, albeit a liberal lens, a very supportive lens, but you're looking at it through only one lens of scholars. So that's important. You think about yourself, you really look at the program, and then you have to really think about who's in my room. You know, again, I have the advantage of running a Montessori school, and a bottom line philosophy of Montessori is not I teach kindergarten, but I teach this year's kids in this year's kindergarten class. So I know my materials, but I have to think about who's in this room and how my materials are going to affect the kids in this room. If I have one black child and 20 white children, well, that child is going to have a certain experience, especially if the conversation about race comes up. So I have to be thoughtful. Who's in the room? How are they all going to feel as we go through this curriculum? Am I, you know, there's another famous, wonderful expression called windows and mirrors. Am I providing enough windows so that the kids can see through to each other's lives? But is my curriculum providing enough mirrors so that every single child in my classroom sees themselves in the curriculum? And then they feel like they belong. If my classroom is only windows, then I'm looking into someone else's life and I don't belong. Wow. So these are all great ways for a teacher to be inclusive and to create a inclusive classroom.
That's really, really interesting. I never even looked at it like that, because I think, yes, so when I myself walk into a room and I'm teaching, I need to first think about, well, how do I come into this room as a teacher in all of the things that make me who I am? And how is that, I don't know, maybe reflecting towards the students? Because to be honest with you, when I've gone into classrooms, for instance, I teach acting, and the majority of my children are white upper class children. And sometimes I wonder what they think about me as an African-American woman. Are their parents open to the idea that, you know, I am who I am? Because I do live in a very conservative area of Ohio, and it's different. And I've never had any problems, but that always is something that comes to my mind at the first day of class when I'm teaching. So it's very interesting to hear you say what you just said about the windows and mirrors, especially in how I come into the classroom and who I am. And a lot for me to think about, moving forward.
this may not be part of this conversation, but Patricia, I started as a theater teacher.
Oh, did you really? Okay.
So what you're also, there's also a piece of exotic, right, to theater. So you as a Black teacher, even amongst a bunch of white kids, might seem like the acting, the theater, magical. And so again, kind of what kids bring to us and what we bring to kids in that classroom exchange, there are so many layers that have nothing to do with the book you read or, the things you're talking about in the classroom. That's the whole point of, I think, really understanding a class where everyone feels they belong, that it's an inclusive class, that as a teacher you've pushed yourself beyond the materials to the exchange, to the social, emotional, thoughtful exchange that's happening in that classroom between each child and between the children and you, or children and me, and for me as the head of school, between me and the faculty. There's so many pieces that go into our inner exchange with each other.
Absolutely. Wow. Okay. So in your view, what strategies do educators find most effective in establishing a learning environment where every student, is regardless of their ethnicity, disabilities, gender, sexual orientation, or background, has an equitable chance to actually thrive?
Yeah, I love this question. Because for me, the question is asking for strategies. And what I want to start with is the word belonging, or that window mirror. Have I all the strategies I need to think of? I need to be a great teacher. I need to have the greatest sense of pedagogy and curriculum delivery and the things I learn in graduate school about strategies for teaching. But I have to kind of, in order to have a really inclusive classroom where kids thrive, my mainstay needs to be, does every kid in this class feel like they belong? And quite frankly, it's science. It's the science of learning. If part of my brain is sitting in the class worried about what others are thinking about me, or should I even be in this classroom? Do I belong? So I run an expensive private school in New York City. A lot of kids, we try to be as generous as we can with flex tuition, yet there's no way that child should ever be made to feel that they got in and they're lucky and they're getting money to go to the school, because then that part of their brain is busy saying, I don't really belong here, I'm lucky to be here. No, the strategies need to make sure a child belongs. The other strategies for a teacher is that I have to keep an open growth mindset about how to teach and how to learn. Going back to that example that I gave you, that teacher had great intentions and had picked some really incredible scholars with whom she was familiar, but she needed to be open to the mindset that said, wait a minute, if all of your scholars are talking about race, but they're all one race and they're all happen to be the majority race, they can be informed about race, but they're still going to look at it through a certain lens. So the strategies have to be, I have to be like up for professional development, up for what's the current thinking about, what are the current readings? Who are the current writers? Who are the best first grade storytellers that will give me the books that will make my children feel that there's a mirror when they come into the classroom? Oh, there's me. Not as the sidekick, not as the other kid, but as the main character of the story, so this goes from kindergarten through college learning, right? The strategies are, I wrote down, prepare the curriculum and keep reviewing the curriculum. You have to employ a strategy of real empathy with your students. Do you seek feedback from them? Do you listen? Do you talk with someone else? Do you review with your colleagues and say, hey, this is what I'm thinking about for my curriculum? There's all sorts of, again, great, thoughtful, smart resources if I want to be an inclusive teacher and have all of my students thrive. But the biggest thing is the humility to go, this is a wide open field where we're every day learning new stuff about it. So I have to be humble and work with someone else and review my stuff and have an open mindset to my own work. Because you're also, I mean, we're going to, you know, your next question about, you know, kind of, there's also a group of people who really think this is not a good approach to education or a waste of time. So you're going to have to also kind of wade or you know, be the salmon swimming upstream in some, it will feel that way sometimes as well.
Okay, so let's talk about that, the pros and the cons of the inclusive things that we're trying to get people to adapt to that may not always be a good thing for some, maybe the parents or, you know, others.
So I'm not a great resource to give you the cons of why this is important for teaching, I'll be honest.
Okay, and that's fair.
I think, because for me, the pro of this teaching is very clear. It's fed by brain science. It's not even fed by a social desire on my part, although I think it does address some moral ideas and some social justice ideas. But for me, the pro of this is very much brain science. If a child is busy in the classroom and there's no mirror, they haven't seen themselves in the curriculum, they haven't felt included in the curriculum, something is said in the curriculum, if a writer, if a bias comes up on the way a teacher responds or doesn't respond, you know, silence is a huge damage in a classroom. The kid says something, the teacher doesn't say anything, the kid, you know, goes, wow, the teacher didn't even, you know, talk. That kid just said a really mean thing toward me and the teacher didn't recognize that. Or that kid just said a really striking thing about race. And again, back to intent and impact. I had a classroom where they opened up the map and there was the country of Niger on the map. One kid said, hey, look at that, a country is named, and said the word. Now, no one called that kid racist.
Yeah.
But there was a great learning moment to say, wait a minute, A, that's not how it was pronounced, but B, if you just shout something like that out in the classroom, regardless of whether you see the word or not, it's gonna affect others in the room.
Right.
So for me, it's brain science. Any brain power that you have that's being used to protect yourself, to feeling left out, to seeking some sort of connection, to being afraid of how something's going to come, you're quickly using up, you know, here's the full gas tank of learning. And if you use up this much of the gas tank of learning about protecting and worry and thought, you only have this much brain with which to learn. Mm-hmm. So it's the pro for me is a kid's going to thrive when the whole brain feels free to learn. That's brain science. That's not social justice. Now, a pro is also social justice and the need to that we have to have a society where we all belong and we all bring our full value to the society. Now, cons, I don't see any cons to this. I have heard certainly plenty of cons said, you know, the biggest one being this is either, you know, kind of all made up, or this is not, you know, the American pull your bootstraps up and just get by in the best way that you can. Or of course the biggest one is, well, wait, this isn't reading, writing, and arithmetic. This is woke, you know, garbage. Mm-hmm. About other stuff, and we need school to be reading, writing, and arithmetic. And again, I go back to the thing I said before about brain science. My brain will not learn reading, writing, and arithmetic unless I feel like I belong in the classroom.
Okay, now can I just give a potential con?
Absolutely.
I could be wrong.
Absolutely.
So I know there's a lot of saying about, you know, I feel like the whole gender, I'm a woman. If I'm a boy, I feel like I'm a woman. There are things coming in the classroom where students or a student has said that I am a cat. And they have to address the student the way that they feel. Now, I don't know if that is really, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but could that potentially be a con where you get this really extreme side of people wanting to be what they are, how they feel, and it seems absurd to people?
You know, Patricia, I know that story. It's okay. Been shared with me. I think a couple of things. I think as a person who is, you know, in my 60s and has gone through a whole different approach to the way we treat gay and lesbian people, I think these things are journeys. The idea of trans, you know, kids who are experiencing gender identity that's not their biological identity, is a deeply thoughtful, you know, part of our lives. And yet it's, number one, it is like the bellwether for attack, you know, so it's going through stuff that I went through as a gay person in the 70s and early 80s. You know, you brought AIDS upon you because you're morally wrong. So I think that, you know, we don't yet know. I mean, we've got to be more, you know, comfortable. I know researchers who are really, really, really deeply thoughtful and careful when they're working with young children on, you know, the deeply confusing thoughts that are troubling them because they identify in a gender different than the gender they were born. Is that something that should be taken lightly? Of course not. That's a giant piece. But as always, we can quickly go find a quirky story. Look, I wasn't in the classroom. I understand that there was a school where a kid said, I want to be a cat, and the teacher said, okay, I'm going to treat you like a cat. And you know, I'm not there, lest I judge kind of what led to all that, how long it lasted. Was it a 1 month thing that a kid was playing with? I wanted a different name when I was growing up. I wanted to, you know, and people appeased me. And I'm not saying that to minimize what we're talking about, but I am saying that, you know, as we go through this journey, and this is a significant piece of now, a lot of young people, you know, many, many young people have no problem with, you know, kind of gender fluidity. So, some still do, but many don't. Most of it is us adults, and it hasn't been part of our brains. So I guess my response to your con in a long way, the shorter response is, I can find a lot of quick examples as to the ridiculousness of many things. I can find very quick answers to some of the anti-woke choices that people make. Even the fact that they, you know, have misappropriated a word that was created, you know, to be woke, to be thoughtful, and now that's turned into the devil word. We can quickly find lots of examples, ridiculous examples, that amplify our why we're con something.
Okay.
And so for me, as an educator, as teachers, it has always been our job to think deeply, to research deeply, to look deeply, and to not grab the first kind of ridiculous example to then, you know, completely wipe away a whole set of deeply thoughtful researched ideas. I don't think kids should, you know, I think you can recognize, just like I wanted to use my middle name as my name. Okay, that's one thing. But then we're into a much deeper set of questions when a kid is genuinely, genuinely troubled and deeply confused. And again, it's affecting their ability to use their brain because they just are caught in a gender quagmire of who I've been born and what I'm feeling. So we need to look at that and not dismiss it. And it's minimized if I just dismiss this, like, oh, here we go. So now if kid wants to be a cat, we got to treat him as cats.
Okay. Well, I mean, see your point. Yeah. So it's not, yeah. So like minimizing it, it makes it seem like you're going to make everything ridiculous that has had a lot of deep thought put into it. We don't want to do that. And I think this exception is something that, okay, that's that. But what we're talking about in terms of gender is a deeply thought out science around people and how they feel in their bodies and what they
and
were born with.
It's still developing and it's still happening.
It's still happening.
So,
yeah.
So we developing. Cannot, I mean, there were ridiculous excuses that people used to justify slavery, to justify the treatment of gay and lesbian.
That's a good point. Yeah. Okay.
And at the time, at the moment, that seemed perfectly, I guess, reasonable to the person.
Yeah. And biblical, a lot of times they would make it. Yeah. Yeah.
How can you fight the Bible? Mm-hmm. You know, well, they're gay and lesbian. How can you fight the Bible? And yet, you know, again, with some deep thought, there are a number of scholars who have pointed out a lot of, you know, a lot of those places that were used biblically to justify slavery or anti-gay, lesbian, with a more thoughtful read of what was originally intended in the context in which it was presented and what's being said in the Bible, you can read this stuff through your current bias and lens, or you can be open and ask, well, what's being asked here? And I think that's the biggest thing. It's just being open to what is really being sought here and thought about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So teaching students who exhibit diverse behavioral challenges, what are the challenges, if any, and how can teachers sustain patience when working with such students?
Yeah, and it's funny because this is one question where you could go back to our original conversation about inclusion, mm-hmm. You know, behave like a kid who's genuinely struggling with attention deficit could have certain behaviors. A kid on autism spectrum could have certain behaviors. Now, also a kid, a trans kid who really, part of their journey is to really seek attention, so they really, you know, dress with abandon to the what everyone else feels is the norm. And again, everyone feels is the norm. I'm not saying is the norm. But so all these are potential behavioral things. We have a horrible, horrible record of incarcerating our young Black men. We have a horrible record of when you look at who gets expelled, who gets suspended at so many schools, it's, you know, young Black boys are getting suspended at a gigantic rate. So is that behavioral, or is that my bias? Is that, you know, am I reacting a certain way because this isn't fitting what I want the norm to be in my room? So for me, you know, I wrote down here, the more you seek to understand, the deeper you have patience.
Hmm. Yeah.
So the more a teacher learns about who this child is, what the behavior is, I mean, you know, a lot of thinking about kids who have to kind of, the word's slipping out of my mind right now, but you kind of cross your cultural barrier. So you come from one neighborhood, and if you're in a certain school, you're meeting with an entirely different set of behaviors. And so you're busy trying to figure out what's the behavior that will let me fit in, you know? And so again, you know, the more that I understand as the teacher, the more that I understand what a kid is bringing to that behavioral situation, even if it's, and you know, again, the right school, we've admitted some kids, and then they really, we couldn't serve them. They were on a certain autism spectrum. Their behavior was such that it was disrupting all of the rest of the kids, and we weren't helping that kid nor the rest of the school. So we helped that parent find a school where that kid would feel that they belonged, you know? Mm-hmm. So again, the more you know, the much deeper you're able to have patience with a situation. Mm-hmm. The more something is weird to you or scary to you or unknown to you, you have a lot less patience.
Right. Okay. Yes. Good. So how can early childhood settings effectively integrate inclusive practices, and what methods can be employed to actively engage parents in this process? Maybe the parents are even clueless or need help with that, and the school can help because of all their training and work with other students.
Yeah, I mean, I love that because the school I happen to run right now happens to be a toddler through fifth grade school. Mm-hmm. This is a particularly important question to me because I do think, you know, sometimes people will claim, oh, you know, age appropriate, or this isn't something that we should talk about. Well, learning is always age appropriate. So in early childhood and kindergarten, there's wonderful just stories. Children love stories. So the stories you use in the classroom can provide that mirror and those windows that your kids can then have a chance to say, oh, wow. You know, we have a wonderful book that, you know, says it's about the color of us. And our young children like to explore, well, why is my skin color different from yours? Mm. So again, we're talking about difference as an exciting thing, and we're not talking about, you know, deep-seated racial issues of many years with a four-year-old, but we are talking about something they look at and notice every day. You're a different color than me. Is that good? Is that bad? Is that okay? What does that mean? And then we can move into their families. And we can also talk about the families and bring the family stories of the kids that are in your classroom or you know, other family stories. So there's wonderful fiction stories, there's actual family stories, all of which, again, what's it about for early childhood? That I belong in this classroom. That this is my classroom, just like it's your classroom. You know, and especially if I'm different than a lot of kids in the classroom, it's very easy for my brain to feel like I don't belong. And so how do I, as a teacher, make sure you all belong here? I'm so glad you're all my students. You know, I always say to our teachers, we have to make the children feel known. We have to make them feel understood. And we have to make a child feel like I need you in my room. I am so lucky to have you in my classroom. Can you imagine how that makes like a four-year-old feel if the teacher says, I need you in my room. I'm so lucky to have you in my classroom. So, I mean, the sense of belonging, and then as far as parents go, I think it's being totally transparent about what you're doing regarding children belonging in your class. I think it's totally, so one of the things that we do, and we borrow this or we're grateful to receive this gift from a co-school here in New York. It's called the Dalton School. We visited and they had these wonderful things called diversity book bags. And so we put together four or five wonderful, wonderful stories that are, you know, broadly reflective windows and mirrors of different families, different folks, age appropriate for that grade level. And one child from the classroom will take that book bag home on Monday. And we ask the parents to read several of those stories and then mark down in the journal in the book bag what was the conversation for your family around these stories. And so we're providing materials. And we've, you know, before we do that, we have a very clear, you know, kind of introduction of what this is about for the parents. So we're providing the parents some materials, we're providing them guidance, and they get to just sit home and have a conversation. I guess if a particular parent doesn't like one of the books, they can read some of the other books.
Okay. So if someone, I was going to say if they didn't like it, they can simply not address it?
Well, we need them to know that every one of the books in this book bag has already been addressed with your children. We've already talked about class.
Okay.
We want to be transparent about the ways we're including people in the class. Mm-hmm. But we are, you know, as you say, how do you actively engage the parents? Well, again, I think if you give the parents something to do as part of your, you know, kind of this work within your school, we love to invite our parents in at, you know, we start at 8:30. We love to invite them in from 8:30 to 9 a couple times a year. You can come in and read stories to your child, come in and write with your child, do math projects with your child. The more, especially with these younger children, it is a key time to have parental involvement and parental connection to the work. Parents want it happening in the classroom. And so I think as a school, it's your responsibility to provide opportunity.
Right. And I'm sure they want to because it's costing them a pretty penny too, right? I mean, want to be engaged. But some of the parents that I work with, it depends on the class, but, you know, the parents aren't as engaged. So I guess that can be a problem when you bring something home and then they really perk up to something that they didn't know was happening. And then you get like problems and, around what you're teaching all of a sudden, because they're not paying anything, but they definitely have an input on it. And
I think the more that you have clarity, and whether it's, again, I run a private school, so you're choosing to come to this school.
Right.
But again, a superintendent, a school board has to be very clear about what they're intending to do. And it is a really tough time, because there's plenty of stories, Patricia, there's plenty of your listeners who, are involved in volatile, school board meetings, et cetera. So, we're in a time of almost accepting that, vigorous I'm anti you, and so therefore I can yell or shout or, God forbid, other things. And so we're in a time where we have to keep, again, clarity about what you're doing, communication about what you're doing, thoughtful empathy to what you're afraid of, but what we're trying to do based on brain science, that every kid in this room is feels they belong, is the best situation I know, to involve and to respond. Parents should have a reaction. It's what their kid is experiencing.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, so are there any long-term effects associated with inclusive teaching? If so, what potential outcomes do you anticipate? I know that you're probably going to say no, right? I mean, I think that this is all good.
The potential effect.
Yeah. Or if
everybody feels that they belong.
Yeah, good effect.
So they
right.
thrive.
Yeah.
For too many years, there's this great research about just gender, about kind of the early 70s. And the researcher was talking to young men kind of post-college. So they were in kindergarten in the early 70s. So mid-80s, late 80s, post-college, all these boys who just were like not going to college, not succeeding in school. And what they found in the research was that in the early 70s, the thinking in education was to really push language arts deeply into kindergarten, early childhood stuff. And we know, again, all of these statements, genetic statements, are, probably 80%, but the majority of females are more open to language, to relational conversations earlier than the majority of boys.
Mm-hmm.
That's just been shown by years of research. And so what this guy found was that by curricularly, when we were pushing language arts, these boys in kindergarten just could see the teachers liked the girls, were happy the way they responded to the way the girls responded to these lessons, and they could see they were frustrated by the boys who weren't getting the lessons, who weren't really interested in the lessons. And so these boys early on really internalized the idea of schools for girls, schools are not for me. So, again, when you're talking about long-term effects, the point is that the intention was that earlier on kids would learn to read and love literature. The long-term effect, based on all kinds of things about the way the brain works, was that here we were in the late 80s finding this whole generation of young men that had very strongly internalized schools for girls, not for me. So, when you're looking at long-term effects, it's so fascinating. You tell me what are the potential negative long-term effects that you won't get enough reading, writing, and arithmetic in, that you will waste time on woke subjects? I'm not sure what the argument is as to long-term effects.
I don't know. I think sometimes you have all these compounds that you're thinking about, and maybe things get muddled and you're not really focusing on the learning, and you're putting too much effort and thought into something that some people may think is, waste of time, or we're diving too deep, is getting too, particular, and I don't know. I just think there's always some kind of effect or from doing something to the extreme almost.
I hear you. I am still in contact with a family that used to be here, and I love lots of things, and they will sometimes, post or talk about their concerns about the trans work in schools. And, you know, mm-hmm. they had a post that, can you imagine people are wasting time with gender neutral dolls, and that's taken over the curriculum. Well, Patricia, at the cabinet school, one of the many incredible opportunities children have in a day full of activities is that we do have a set of gender neutral dolls. So we're helping kids think about, you know, why do I say that only girls can have long hair? Or why do I say that only boys can be construction workers? What is that about? Great conversation. It's one of a zillion pieces that happen in the classroom. Lots of reading, lots of writing, lots of arithmetic. But again, we go back to that cat story. We point to one moment and say, oh my gosh, can you imagine how much time is being wasted on these gender neutral dolls that could be spent on other things? Well, quite honestly, the truth is it's the exact opposite of that. A tiny piece that could well affect a child's, you know, strong biases might happen in the Cadman classroom, along with rigorous, rich learning, where kids' brains are on fire because they feel safe and they feel like they belong. And they're gaining so much insight into their use of numbers and their ability to read. So, you know, that's when I look at long-term effects, I'm back to our story before. Well, how deeply have we looked at, and what are the stories of long-term effects? And are we grabbing like snippets of concerns and suggesting those snippets are going to create the long-term effects? When in fact, mm-hmm. we know through brain science, if a kid has the ability to belong in a classroom, the long-term effects of their educational experience will be outstanding. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're gonna go into a world with openness and innovation and empathy and a sense of questioning and a sense of deep curiosity and a sense of questioning and learning about themselves and learning about, well, why are these the rules and the laws as they become citizens? Are these the right rules and laws that are fair to everybody? Mm-hmm. That to me is the long-term effect I want to create in a school.
That's really interesting way of, I think, saying it. It's about love. It's about just showing empathy and bringing people together so that we can, I don't know, all get along and there's not so much divisiveness in the world and conflict.
School, you know, school listening about all that soft stuff of love and getting along. I don't want that in my school. I'll talk about that at home.
Yes, right. Okay.
But exactly what you said. The outcome of thoughtful, science-driven learning includes an open mindset to the power of what's happening in the classroom. The unintended or the intended outcome will also be a sense of getting along, a sense of listening to someone else, instead of, I hear something you say that pushes my button and then I react, rather than I deeply listen. What are you really saying?
Exactly, that you're really listening more. I think that's what it is. It's being able to listen and understand rather than just reacting and going off of your ignorance, essentially, you know? Okay, so what would your final message be to our listeners in summing everything up?
Well, the truth is, as much as I've talked about brain science, which I agree, I think this is a moral imperative. If we're gonna move beyond, you know, I say to my 20-year-old nephew all the time, I say, we have screwed this thing up so badly, and we are so polarized and so awful to each other. Your generation has got to fix this. I don't know if mine can, but you can. you can listen to people more carefully. You can want to fix rather than want to protect. So even though I think I've made it very clear why I think this is a scientifically thoughtful idea about education being inclusive and helping everyone belong, I do think it's an enormous moral imperative for educators to want every kid, every single kid, to feel, I belong in this classroom, and therefore I'm going to thrive in this classroom. It's our job.
Wow. Ray, thank you so much, Matthew. Absolutely. That was beautiful.
Thank you. Good.
All right. I'm glad we got started with this conversation, and I'll continue it in other ways and become more educated and learn more, because I'm learning so much just from talking to so many well-educated educators about so many different topics. It's awesome.
Well, thank you for including me. I was thrilled to be the person to talk about this topic in a way that I hope, you know, kind of offered a perspective, again, as I said, as a white male, and yet for me, this is a moral imperative. And it starts with me and my own journey about what I bring to the table, because I'm not perfect and I make lots of mistakes in this area all the time.
Yeah, we're always learning. Okay, well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
We would also like to give a special thanks to Ali Forsey, Kademan's Communications Director. In the name of Life Smart Education and the Grow Global Podcast, we want to thank you both for the service in the fields of education, diversity, and equity and inclusion. Wow, that was really an inspiring conversation around inclusive teaching. Are you in favor of inclusive teaching? Let us know. We want to hear from you. Email us your questions and opinions at info@lifesmarteducation.org with the subject line inclusive teaching. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at LifeSmartEducation. Today's show was produced by Keith Richardson, edited and written by Christine Emmanuel Lopez, no relation. Our show media producer is JD Johnson, and we want to thank all of our friends over at Platinum Credit Group and our friends at WCBE 90.5 FM for sponsoring this podcast and making it happen. I'm Patricia Demetrio, your host for Grow Global, the president and founder of Life Smart Education. Thank you so much for listening.
At an early age, Stefano May realized that music would help him find his way and that his passion might help others too.
We all born with a mission. My mission was to communicate. And when I started writing music, the biggest inspiration was to describe everyday's life. I witnessed a lot of things that weren't really great. My intent was trying to translate these bad emotions in good emotions. And when you do it with music, you have the power to do it.
Learn about Stefano May and hear his inspirational songs and moving messages on the latest edition of Music Journeys, available on the major podcast platforms and WCBE's podcast experience hub at wcbe.org.